jadi siapa with the departure of the Vice Chancellor, it's my opportunity to continue as chair for this part of our program and introduce to you our two additional keynote speakers this morning. And these two keynote speakers are really the inspiration for this entire program and the driving force behind it. We'll first have the opportunity to hear from Dean Kofi Kwajigha. Following Dean Kwajigha, we'll hear from Professor Cole Durham, my colleague at the International Center for Law and Religion Studies. For those of you who don't know Dean Kwajigha's background, he's an associate professor and dean here in the Faculty of Law at the University of Ghana. He's formerly a Fulbright scholar at the Harvard Human Rights Program and also a visiting fellow at the University of Wisconsin. He is a star teacher here at the law school, a star administrator, as I say, the one who made this happen. And then following his keynote address, we'll hear from my colleague, whom I think you know, and there's a biography here in the program. But what I know Cole as is someone who is dedicated to the principles of religious liberty and dedicated in the broadest, most ecumenical sense to learning and understanding and growing with each of those colleagues he has all around the world as he tries to understand the legal dimensions of religious liberty. And it's been exciting during my career at BYU Law School to watch his efforts in that area. So I'm pleased now to turn the mic over to Dean Kwajigha.
Thank you very much, dear Razvan. This second keynote address provides me the opportunity to put across a very touchy issue from several perspectives. Now, I have titled my address The Need for a Rethink of the Influence of the Religions on Law and Governance in the State in Africa. It is not the need for a rethink of the influence of religion, but rather of the religions. Now, I take this meeting of experts here as a very important opportunity to begin to test these my ideas. And I'm hoping that at the end of this conference, we would have begun a kind of, though perhaps academic, rethinking of the role that we should assign to religions in governance in Africa in particular. Now, we need not belabor the fact that the denial of religious liberty is to me perhaps the most invidious means available for those that contrive to dehumanize other fellow human beings, and perhaps the most devastating weapon that can be deployed for that purpose is the law operating, as it always does, through the instrumentality of the state. That is, using the state, the law, and the state to achieve parochial religious interests. The use of the state, the use of law and state for such purpose could be listen and open, whereby the state proclaims open support for a particular religion, where others may just be tolerated or outrightly prohibited. Examples can be found in the Constitution of Mauritania, which proclaims Islam not only as the state religion, but also that a citizen can only aspire to be head of state if a Muslim. Similarly, the Constitution of Malawi, which in the preamble declares Christianity as a state religion, but without expressly limiting the presidency, for instance, to only Christians. Those are open or express declarations of support, state support for particular religions. Now, apart from the outright proclamation of a state religion, it is subtle subjection of sections of the population of a country to obedience to laws and policies that are inherently the tenets of the religious beliefs of some groups. Minorities become disadvantaged in conscience and in fact because they feel inhibited because of the position of minority. They feel inhibited from challenging those kinds of laws, which by dint of being dominant, the others, the dominant groups, think that should be the law, and the others have no choice but to abide by them. Now, in my title, I try to distinguish between religion and the religions. This finds some support in Lewis Henkin, who, following the steps of other theologians, philosophers, and academics, also endeavored to distinguish between religion and religions. According to which distinction, religion becomes general and abstracted as against religions, which is a reference to particular religious, concrete, historical communities, members, practices, and boundaries. I am not suggesting that religion as a notion should be completely ignored. No. We should have the liberty as individuals to determine how we want to conceive and relate to God. But the state should be careful not to allow itself to be used by religions to achieve some purpose. The colonial experience of African countries brought in Israel the infusion of civil law with religious injunctions. Similarly, systems of government tend to reflect the influence of the colonized nation's religious inclinations. This religious influence persists even into these modern times, when various communities have become increasingly mixed. So if you take, for instance, those countries that were colonized, the dominant religious influence on law and governance would be seen to be the Judeo-Christian tradition. Similarly, those that were dominated by Islam, we find that influence dominating. According to a poll, a 2010 poll, a majority or substantial majority of Christians favor making the Bible the official law of the land, while similarly, large numbers of Muslims say they would like to enshrine Islamic law in the civil laws of the country. In Nigeria, for example, 70% of Christians favor biblical support for civil laws, while 71% of Muslims favor making Sharia the official law. Uganda has 64% for Christians and 66% for Muslims. Ghana, 70% for Christians and 58% for Muslims. Liberia, 63% for Christians, 52% for Muslims. And then you can find the examples replicated in almost every other African country. Now, these figures to me confirm the deep religious nature of the African and the desire to have their religious norms integrated into their ways of life. It is, however, the proposition that the modern African state, particularly the Republican state, will better be served if the religions and their respective norms are kept out of the regime of the law and governance. This proposition follows from the conviction that the infusion of religions and their tenets into the ordinary laws and of their further influence in governance would increasingly generate conflicts within the body politics. It would create opportunities for politically ambitious individuals and groups to endeavor to utilize the powerful institutions of the religions to achieve and perpetuate their interests in increasingly multi-religious societies of Africa. It is from this observation that Karl Marx had argued that it is the economically dominant group whose religious convictions generally become the religious influence of the rest of the population. The right to religious freedom is a fundamental prerequisite for every other right, physical and conceptual, and the worst form of abuse and discrimination that can happen to any human being is to be persecuted for the reason of how one conceives and practically relates to God. A person whose physical liberty is restrained is very much alive if his or her religious conviction remains strong. But that person who has been denuded of his or her faith is dead. That is the more reason why the laws of the land should not impose religious tenets on others and use state infrastructure to compel conformance. The Constitution of Ghana, for instance, prohibits Parliament from promulgating a law that would promote or impose a particular religion on the people, religious belief on the people. Nevertheless, if you study the laws of many countries, you still find the influence of the dominant religion, be it Islam or Christianity, in those religions. I have often asked myself, what is the problem with the African marrying more than one wife? Now, if you look at the constitution, the criminal law of Ghana, if I marry under the ordinance, which essentially is a reflection of Christian, Judeo-Christian tradition, I can only marry one wife. If I should marry a second woman who has the first marriage is subsisting, that is bigamy, and I can be prosecuted under the criminal law of Ghana. But if my brother marries under customary law, he is at liberty to marry more than one, and the law finds nothing wrong with that. It's not criminal. If my Muslim cousin marries 1, 2, 3, 4, there is no problem with that also. So my question is this: what is the law protecting? Is the law not to protect that which is socially or economically not proper? If that is the case, then we have to decide. If marrying one woman is not socially permitted, then so be it for all of us, whether Christian, Muslim, or traditionalist. But here we are in the Ghanaian law, we have an example of religious norm being transformed into our regular laws with the support of the state. Now, in his paper on religion, the state and law in Africa, the writer, Mr. Eko, identified three broad categorizations of the relationships between religion and the state in Africa as follows. 1, separation of church and state. 2, separation of religion over the state. And 3, subordination of religion to the state. A study of the various constitutions of the countries of Africa will place some in the first category and others in the second. The third phenomenon, that is subordination of religion to the state, is work of attitude where one finds some particular individuals utilizing the influence of religion for political purposes. The story in that write-up, and I've heard it before, the story is told of some leaders, for instance, President Nkrumah, whom I respect so much, being accused of giving himself appellations that would equate him to the Almighty for political reasons. Other examples have been given. In the first group, that is a separation of church and state, you have the constitution of a number of countries that categorically separate, call for the separation of church from the state. Examples are Angola, Benin, Burundi, Cameroon, Cape Verde, Central African Republic, Chad, Mali, Mozambique, Senegal, Burkina Faso, the DR Congo, and some others. This you find are essentially former French or Portuguese colonies. Now, Nserimbu contends that absolute separation of church and state is unattainable, particularly in the circumstances of Africans, because of the obvious fact that the various religions are needed to supplement some social services such as educational, medical, and others. In the strict sense, that is in my view, in the strict sense, being secular should not mean a total exclusion of these religions from those areas of social service. It is possible to conceive their involvement just to the same degree as some ordinary individual could have been involved in the provision and management of such services, but without such individual necessarily exercising any political influence. Secularization does not therefore necessarily exclude the religions from participation in the provision of the social services. In their bid to serve the society, however, the religions must keep within the law, as would have been set out by the political authorities. If I want to establish an educational institution or a hospital, I'm at liberty to do that. But that doesn't give me the leeway or any extra privilege to want to influence government policies or the law beyond what the ordinary person could do. The same should be for the religions. They should be at liberty to establish schools, churches, etc., but not to the degree of having their influence becoming the law. Now, with respect to the supremacy of religion over the state, it is when dominant religion or religions control the state and its institutions that those social services, particularly education, become tools for proselytizing and individuals who are not adherents become compelled to subject themselves to the overwhelming influence of the dominant groups. That was a situation in the old monarchies that were built around some religious convictions. Those were the periods when the monarch determined the religious leaning of the subjects, and other non-religionists existed at the pleasure of the monarch. With our republic, the conception that ius regio is religio is a Latin expression that meant simply that the religion of the ruler dictated the religion of the ruled. That was the position during the 16th centuries. If I am the monarch, my religion is the religion of the state. If you are not satisfied, if you are not comfortable with it, back out and go to wherever you want. Now, during the 16th century, this principle was adopted to end the religious wars in Europe. It nevertheless failed to secure religious freedom in an increasingly pluralistic religious environment, even in those days. Now, the failure of religions to uphold the dignity of human beings, even within some specific religions themselves, within the membership of some religions, is known. And that is the more reason why we must endeavor to keep religion out of the affairs of the law, the influence, this influence of the law and the governance of the states. Now, this can have negative implications for religions also, as you may see from the examples of the Sudan and Rwanda. In other words, if religious support for the state, if a particular religion is seen to be rooting for the state or vice versa, if something goes wrong in governance in the state, religion is blamed for it. Religion will carry the blame for the failure of the state in certain respects. I don't think that is what religions want to carry as their baggage. The example of Sudan is well known. The push for Arabization and Islamization of the whole country to the utter disregard of the southern part of Sudan, which is blamed for the war, and which perhaps has been described as the most devastating human catastrophe in Africa in terms of the consequences of the war, remains with us. And because it was a conflict that had to do with religion, the positions were difficult to mediate. And the end result is what we have now. The separation between the North, Islamic North, and the Christian South. Then if you take the case of Rwanda, statistics is given to the effect that 91% of the whole population of Rwanda is Christian. But research by Longman shows that more than the large number of those who died during the Rwanda unfortunate situation died on the premises of the churches and at the hands of Christians. There is the recounted story of a priest who was hidden by his fellow priests in a sanctuary. According to him, in the morning, the people come to mass to pray, then they go out to kill. Now, I'm using this just to emphasize my position that perhaps it is better for religions to keep a distance between them and the politicians. Because when things go wrong, the church will be blamed. The church that is seen to be supporting the regime will be blamed. Of course, in the case of Rwanda, the Pope came out to denounce the killings. That, of course, the church does not, it is not part of church teaching that people should kill. Nevertheless, the fact remains on the ground that much of the killings happened in the churches, on the church premises. So perhaps it is better for the churches to create a distance between themselves and the politicians. And that takes me to this issue of republicanism. We have moved away, that is, the states of Africa have moved away from the old monarchies, where, as I said, The religion of the ruler determined the religion of the people. We have now republics, res publica, a government that is of the people. And we have, as presidents, our own selected individuals who just preside. There can therefore be no such opportunity for one group, be it a religion, to have dominant influence on the republic. That is why religions should know their limits, keep within those limits, and the state also keeps within its limits. That essentially is the thesis of my presentation, this keynote address. And I sincerely hope that in the course of the conference, this issue would be further developed. Religion, I want to emphasize, cannot be ignored. Religion, per religion, cannot be ignored. It is part of our lives. But as academics, as practitioners of law and religion, I think it is time for us to begin to question the role of religions in the republican state. To what extent should we permit the influence of religion, or should religions themselves be permitted to have influence on the law and therefore governance in the state? I leave this with us, hoping that at the end of the conference, we could begin to form ideas as to whether my fears are actually genuine and should therefore be considered or not, and we should just forget and move on. Thank you very much.